going to continue on a little bit on the subject of linkage disequilibrium, because there's a few interesting things left in that. We're almost on schedule in the class, so I think we're not too bad. I'm going to project something in a moment, so let me do this part up here. You will recall that we had the definition of linkage disequilibrium is just the difference between the frequency of the gamete that you're following and, let's say, big A, big B. And there's its frequency in among the pool of gametes minus what it would be if it were just randomly assembled from gene pool for locus A and a gene pool for locus B. Now, that means you can, of course, rearrange it very easily and say that the gamete frequency is equal to this product plus B. That's, of course, just, I'll put a big A, big B on that. That's just by moving terms left and right. And the other gametes have a similar expressions with one little twist. Each one is the frequency, let's see, I could just put P big A, P little b, but I can also do the latter as 1 minus P big B. So we'll do that just this time. And these are the frequencies you would have if they were just randomly assembled, if there were no associations of presence of a big A with presence of a big B. Now, if you could put a separate D for each of these, but they aren't independent of each other. Because, for example, the first two gametes here have to add up to the frequency of big A. And when you work on that, you'll see it implies that this disequilibrium here can be written in terms of that one as just minus that one. Because then when you add up those two right-hand sides, the D's will cancel out, and the PB plus 1 minus PB become 1. The whole thing becomes the gene frequency. Similarly here, that same D comes in as a minus and down here as a plus. Then everything works out in terms of sums of groups of gametes adding up to the appropriate gene frequency. Like all the gametes that have a big A, if you add them up, that has to be the frequency of big A. Now, that implies you couldn't do all this for multiple alleles at each locus. And in fact, you get D's, a whole bunch of D's, for different, there would be, here, this was also equal to, to D big A little b. You know, there are in principle lots of D's, but then they have some constraints on them because the gene frequencies have to add up. And what you end up with is that if you had, let's say, K alleles at locus A and L alleles at locus B, so you had like 7 alleles at the first locus and 3 alleles at the second locus, you might think, well, you've got 21 different gametes that you could have, so you'd have 21 different D's, but they then are related to each other, so everything adds up properly. And it turns out the number of disequilibrium parameters you'll need is K minus 1 times L minus 1. When those are two alleles at each locus, that's 1 times 1, it's 1. So you just need 1 D, as you did here, when you have larger numbers. You need a whole bunch of disequilibrium parameters, but they're not quite as many as you have gametes. I just wanted to mention that. Okay. Now, if one of the things you can do is ask, well, D is just a very straightforward premise, how far off you are in the gamete frequency from what you would be at pre-association, at linkage equilibrium. What people have tried to do is make other D measures that scale the D according to how big it can get and how small it can get. There are two of those. One of them is a sort of correlation parameter. I'll just give the formula here. It's called, well, it's often called little r, and we've been using that for recombination, so let me call it rho. It's the disequilibrium divided by the product of the gene frequencies. Let's see if I get this right. The product of p and 1 minus p at the A locus and p and 1 minus p at the B locus, all square rooted. That's a kind of correlation coefficient D measure, and it sort of stays in the range minus 1 to plus 1. Can't get any bigger than that. But it's not, it has some good properties mathematically. But there's another one, there's another parameter, another measure like this, another way of rescaling the D. And that's a thing called D prime. And that one, what you do is you take D and divide it by basically the absolute value of, let's say, the biggest, it's never written this way, but I'm going to write it this way, that big D, that the absolute value of D, that's this thing, could get with those gene frequencies. And what that turns out to be, well, you look over here and you'll see, if D were positive, it could be, if you got D as big as this thing here, then the gamete frequency is down to zero. Big D couldn't get any more positive without that going negative. So if D is greater than zero, the denominator is, I'll put up here, denom is the minimum of P big A 1 minus P big B, and this other thing here, 1 minus PB, PA rather, times PB. So basically, you just sort of look at those gametes and say, well, D couldn't get any bigger than whichever one of these gets to zero first. And similarly, for negative Ds, you divide by the minimum of PAPB and the other guy, 1 minus PA, 1 minus PB. Okay. So that's a kind of klutzy scaling because it's kind of got this if thing here, and you change the denominator suddenly as D goes through zero. But it has the advantage that it scales D in a range plus 1 to minus 1, and that's been used a lot. There are good uses for this other one up here, but this one gets used by people doing genomics a fair amount, and there's this triangular graphic display of linkage disequilibrium, which is in the book in chapter 10, I think. Chapter 8. You'll see a display of that, and you see that a certain amount in genomics when they're trying to convey to you pairwise disequilibria. Yes?
Are there generalizations for when there's more than two alleles at each locus for these?
Yes. There are, and they are, it's hard to remember the formulas for them exactly. There is such a thing as a three locus D. Because it's possible to write a set of gametes that are at linkage equilibrium pairwise, but not overall. I'll give you the example, actually. If I have equal frequencies, I don't know if everyone can see this, of big A, big B, big C, big A, little b, little c, if I get this right, little a, big B, little c, and little a, little b is a b, big C. Now, that's not at linkage equilibrium, because there are four, there's a really a total of eight possible gametes. Four of them are missing. So clearly, you're out of linkage equilibrium. Yet, if you look at any pair, for example, look at this pair, there are equal frequencies of big A, big B, big A, little b, little a, big B, little a, little b. That's linkage equilibrium. And same for the other pairs. So there's a simple, silly example of showing that there is something else, some other kind of disequilibrium other than pairwise Ds. And in fact, there is a three-way D, and it's non-zero in this case. They're not frequently computed. And I'll show in a moment, sort of give you a sense of why. In principle, when you have a whole lot of gametes, if you have two alleles each at 10 loci, that's 1,024 possible gametes. There are 10 gene frequencies. There are 10 times 9 over 2, I believe that will be 45 pairwise Ds, combinations of 10 things, 2 at a time. There are combination of 10 things, 3 at a time, 3 locus Ds, combination of 10 things, 4 at a time, 4 locus Ds, and so on. So there's lots and lots of these. And in fact, you need a total of 1,023 parameters to completely describe the frequencies of the 1,024 gametes, since they add up to 1 in frequency. You don't need that last one. So there's lots and lots of these higher order Ds. Basically, nobody ever uses them because they're not terribly useful. But when you're trying to describe a set of gamete frequencies, just instead of just describing the gamete frequencies themselves, but do it in terms of summaries of smaller regions like single sites where you have gene frequencies, or pairs of sites where you have Ds, you can go on up to 3s and 4s and 5s and 6s and drive everybody crazy. And there are even formulas for how those higher order Ds decay away with random mating. And they do involve the recombination fractions in larger regions. And don't make me get into that, okay? Because it's fun. It's great fun and has no use whatsoever. But what I'm going to show you, actually, yeah, please. This is a good time to ask questions.
This may not be associated with that algebra, but yesterday last time you were talking about how recombination reduces the value of genetic association.
Yeah.
And like selection would, if positive, make those two genes be or two loci be associated, right?
If the fitnesses of the two sites interact.
I was having a problem trying to think about how genetic drift would affect linkage disequilibrium.
It basically randomly, that is, on average, doing nothing, but in each particular case, it will take a gamete frequency, and that gamete frequency will drift up a little or drift down a little in frequency, and as it does so, it gets higher than the product of gene frequencies or lower than the product. So the D will go up or down some. And of course, we'll be talking about the strength of genetic drift and showing you that it's inversely related to population size. So the Ds will change by amounts that are inversely related to population size and will wander up and down. Sort of randomly, basically. Selection can either make D positive or make D negative, depending on the kind of interaction between the exact direction of interaction of the fitnesses at the two loci. So you have a question.
Is genetic drift modeled by Brownian motion?
Approximately. But not exactly, because We're working on scales with either gamete frequencies or gene frequencies, which go between 0 and 1. But Brownian motion, if you let it wander, will go further. And so you obviously can't be exactly the same thing. But for large population sizes and small jigglings of Brownian of genetic drift of Brownian motion, you can make Brownian motion approximation. We're going to,
but not in small population.
Well, you can come amazingly close. We are going to get there. You know, that's what we will be spending a lot of time in the last part of the course on, the part that people complain about a lot. People are usually good with this course right up through selection, mutation, migration. They say, gee, that was great, and then I get to genetic drift, and the popularity of the course goes all to hell, basically. That's an exaggeration. So you have these rescaled versions, and D prime is probably the most frequently used, and it's a good descriptive statistic. But I want to show you also a test, a simple test of when two sites show no evidence of recombination. When you'll see that when these D's, when D prime gets to plus one or minus one, it means one gamete of these four has dropped out. There, it isn't there. Okay. That's complete linkage disequilibrium. That is as complete linkage disequilibrium as you can get with those gene frequencies. Now, there's a topic that's going to come up later in the course, coalescence, which has to do with the way copies of genes or copies of regions of genome have a genealogy in the within the population as a result of genetic drift. And we're not, although that's a tree like a tree of species, it's not a tree of species. We're talking about copies of genes within a population. So if we were members of one population, and we looked at some locus, and we look at two copies of that locus, and you ask from one of your copies, where did it come from? Well, maybe it came from your mother, one of her two copies. Where did that come from? One of her ancestors, maybe her father. And so you can imagine yourself tracing a copy of genes from you back through your ancestors, going back through male and female ancestors. You can do that with somebody else in the room. They go trace back through their ancestors. Sooner or later, if you're all within the same species, those two copies will come from the same single copy. You know, maybe tens of thousands of generations back, or maybe more recently. So if you take copies of a site on the genome or a region on the genome and you ask about their ancestry, there is in principle a genealogical tree of those regions. And this genealogical tree is valid, and now you don't know what it is, and you can only get vague hints of it from the sequences, because we're talking about a very limited region of the genome. There's not much variation to go on to make inferences. But nevertheless, it's really out there. And this will hold as long as the region doesn't have a recombination in it. So right away you begin to see, well, maybe this has something to do with linkage disequilibrium, because we're talking about a region of the genome and it's going back to ancestors. But if there was a recombination anywhere in there, it would go back to, the two parts of it would go back to different ancestors. So when you have a recombination in you, you're about to produce a gamete. The recombination in that cell that's going to become the parent of the gamete, and that recombined chromosome is putting together a piece from your mother and a piece from your father into a single gamete. And that means that if there were recombinations on this, then what would happen is a lineage would split and it would come from two ancestors, and there get to be loops in the tree. But as long as it's a perfect tree, there isn't any evidence of recombination. Well, that's all very well to say, but what good does that do us? Well, there's a thing called the three gamete test. And I'll show you what its rationale is in terms of trees. It was invented by I think Richard Dick Hudson at the University of Chicago, who did a lot of early work on recombination and coalescence, very important work. But it also sprang up in another context, and that is a phylogeny. In the late 1960s, it sprang up in the literature for evolutionary trees, for phylogenies, and the same exact test was invented. So let me give you the rationale for this test. Suppose we have such a coalescent tree of copies of genes. We have a sample we've taken, and they are related by some coalescent tree, and there's no recombination. Suppose that somewhere on this tree there was a mutation. The little a allele changed into a big A allele, or DNA sequences, a C changed to a G or something. So there's a region of the tree which is a different gamete. So when there's a mutation, a new gamete type arises. And then if you look at the set of all the gametes that you get, they will have two subsets, the ones that were there originally and the new ones. You can't necessarily tell which is which. And then suppose somewhere else on the tree, now what happened is that mutation created variation at the A locus. The B locus, as we're imagining, is nearby enough that a coalescent tree happens. Suppose over here on the tree a B arose. It creates another new set of gametes. Now you have both loci varying in the sample as a result of mutation. Their relatedness is owing to genetic drift. And there are three kinds of gametes. So you'll see immediately you've got variation of both loci, and you have complete linkage disequilibrium, complete in the sense that this D prime measure is plus one or minus one, because one of the gamete types, capital A, capital B, isn't there. And so the fact of that these mutations can occur on the same tree is the same, it's the same statement as the statement that there is complete linkage disequilibrium between these two sets. So one concept that was invented in population genetics, linkage disequilibrium parameters and scale linkage disequilibrium parameters, connects to the question of whether two different sites both map onto the same tree. And that's where in the phylogeny literature, this test was invented actually by the behavioral ecologist E.O. Wilson in a paper in 1965, before it was invented in population genetics. But nobody put together that these two concepts were the same. If the second mutation had occurred within the part of the tree that the first one did, then you'd get something like this. You would get big A, big B, but you wouldn't get little a, big B. You still have only three kinds of gametes. Your Venn diagram of sets included in each other. There's a Venn diagram here. The purple one is now the all the ones that have a big A. The blue one is the big A, big B, and the rest of the purple one is the big A, little b. The thing about those sets is they get include. They're either disjoint or one included in the other. A footnote, if the second mutation happened to occur in the same branch as the first mutation, either before or after, then these two sets become coincident. Then you have only two kinds of gametes. But in no case do you have four kinds of gametes. So the three gamete test says, is there complete linkage disequilibrium? Is D prime plus or minus one? And the way you judge it is just look at how many different gamete types you have in your sample. And if at the two, when you're looking two sites at a time, if there are three possibilities or fewer, then there's a complete linkage disequilibrium. That also means they all fit on the same tree. In the phylogeny literature, this is called compatibility. The two sites are compatible in the sense that they can both evolve on the same tree. And there's these two ways of thinking about association and trees of genealogy. And so I like to use the phrase that there's a relationship between trees and these. So, and if you're a population geneticist, you get very worked up about disequilibrium parameters, and if you're working in, if you're more phylogeny oriented, you start talking about whether sites are compatible. They're the same notion. They have the same intellectual machinery. So it's a quick and dirty way of looking to see if there is a complete linkage disequilibrium. It's just to see if there's a missing, for sites that have two alternatives, to see if there's a missing gamete type. It gets more complicated if you have more than two possibilities at each site. If you have multiple alleles, let's not go there. So I just wanted to mention that connection. We will come back and we'll be giving you a couple of lectures on on coalescent genealogies and how they form and what you expect to find about their shape, and they've become a very important way of thinking about, particularly about stretches of genome and multi-site genotypes. Okay. Having done that, let's see. Oh yeah, here's another case where the first one, the second mutation occurs before the other one in an ancestor of it. And again, you get a missing. The point is, you start with one haplotype, and each time there's a mutation, you get one more haplotype. In one of these cases where they occur on the same branch, the two mutations give only one new haplotype. But you can't get four haplotypes without repeating one of the mutations or having a recombination. So additional mutation, if a recurrent mutation can do it, or recombination can do it. All right. So, yeah. I've all said. The presence of three haplotypes is a sign that there need not have been any recombination. That's called the three gamete test. Three or fewer, I should say, haplotypes. And all this is stuff I just said, so I don't think I'm going to re-say it. I'm going to instead show you this guy and shift gears. We're going to shift now to natural selection. So last chance for, you can ask me about this stuff any time, but for in-class questions anyway, last chance before we move to natural selection, which is our next big topic. Okay, so I'm going to be showing you the simple mathematics of natural selection at single loci. All of this was worked out starting in the 1910s, which is a big era of getting population genetics off the ground, and then into the 1920s. And in the 1920s, the guy who did more of this than anybody else was J.B.S. Haldane, let's say he's English, but there's some ambiguity about that. People from India claim him as Indian. He had a very colorful life. He is someone I did, in fact, see give a lecture in 1963, the year before he died. He came through the University of Wisconsin, where I was, and I got to see him give a lecture and see him in a small seminar and overhear him talking to people. I was too timid to ever have asked a word of the great man. He was incredibly colorful and a very brilliant and very colorful guy. And there's ambiguity as to his nationality because his family, the Haldanes, were the hereditary barons of Gleneagles in Scotland. Gleneagles, if you go there now, is a place roughly between Edinburgh and Glasgow, and just a little bit further north as you start to get into the Highlands. It's a nice valley, and it is mostly a resort and golf course. But his family used to be the barons of it. His father, John Scott Haldane, was a very famous physiologist, and he was at Oxford University. So J.B.S. Haldane was actually born in Oxford and raised there, although his family was officially Scottish. And when J.B.S. Haldane went to the First World War, he went in a Scottish regiment. And late in life, he emigrated to India, so the Indians all say he's Indian. He grew up in Oxford helping his father with his physiology experiments. His father's work was very famous. There's a Haldane effect in hemoglobin. That's his father's Haldane effect, which has to do with oxygen in hemoglobin, how much oxygen hemoglobin molecules can carry. His father was a person asked by the British government to investigate the phenomenon of the bends. You know, divers were going down and coming up and being attacked by the bends. And the question was, what was this and how do we avoid it? And his father went, and also people going down into deep mines were having the same problem. People working in caissons under rivers, doing foundations for bridges were having it. And his father worked it out and worked out the whole business of nitrogen saturation in the blood and decompressing slowly by coming up. J.B.S. Haldane was an assistant to his father in his father's famous work on breathing physiology, and he continued to work on it some the rest of his life. And in fact, he is responsible. He's famous among people who are divers because in the 1940s, he worked out the tables for mixtures of three gases that you use for very deep diving. And that was done by the son, by J.B.S. Haldane. But J.B.S. Haldane went off to the First World War. He was always a very turbulent person, always getting into fights with the administration wherever he was, and always charging that the administration had it in for him. They undoubtedly found him unreasonable and difficult. He went off to the First World War as an officer in the Black Watch Regiment, was wounded twice in the war. By the way, his uncle, Richard Haldane, was at one point Minister of War in the government, so he was quite well connected. I suppose he could have gotten out of the war, but he went off to the First World War. And he was, of course, being in the Scottish Regiment, he was wearing a kilt, and he liked to take his kilt, fill it with grenades, and go out at night into no man's land to hunt Germans. And he claimed later to have been the only person who enjoyed the First World War. And it worried him later in life that he had enjoyed this war. But he came back and he got into two things. One was genetics. He did a lot of human genetics work in his life, and we'll be coming across bits of it. And he also got into biochemical kinetics, where he was one of the great pioneers. Right after Michaelis and Menten did the Michaelis-Menten rules, there were the Briggs-Haldane rules. And so a lot of the mathematics of the earliest mathematics of biochemical kinetics is done by Haldane, Briggs and Haldane. So he's famous in that area too. When he came through, he worked at the University College London. He worked in and other places. In 1956, he emigrated from Britain and went to India and ended up in Orissa in India after typically having gone somewhere else and had a fight with the administration. And he died in India in 1964. But before that, he was involved during the time of the Second World War in a couple of things, one of which was he became a member of the Communist Party and was a member of its executive. He was high up in the Communist Party in Britain. And he also did work on breathing physiology and advised the British government on the mixtures of gases to be used in mini-subs that they were commissioning to attack the German battleship Tirpitz. Somebody wrote a poem about him once that at that period, and it sort of says, I don't remember the details of the poem, but it says, "What is that box out there in the field, a metal box out there in the field on which people are raining bombs? Oh, that's just Professor Haldane doing experiments." He experimented on himself a lot, exposing himself to explosions and weird gases and so on. He did a lot of that sort of thing. In the 1920s, I guess just to finish up on his personality before I get to this natural selection,
In 1963, he was finally allowed into the United States, having been a communist. He wasn't allowed into the U.S. for a long time, and he went around and gave a lecture tour, and he came through the University of Wisconsin. And what I remember is, at the University of Wisconsin, we had Sewell Wright, who's one of the other great founders of theoretical population genetics, and we were all familiar with Sewell Wright. And so we students were thinking, Haldane is coming. We have to listen as Haldane and Wright converse with each other. The great men will undoubtedly say great things to each other. Well, he came through and he gave a big public lecture. He was, of course, a geneticist of the old school, but what was happening in 1963 was the genetic code was in the process of being broken, which was not done in one experiment, but by multiple experiments. So everyone was excited. They started working out the code table. And when he gave his talk, it was very clear that he referred to that. He was keeping up on the molecular genetics of the day. But I saw him in a small seminar also at that time. And there was Haldane, and there was Wright. And they're perfectly polite to each other. But Wright just did what he always did, which was to mumble about, well, in my 1937 paper I said this, and in my 1944 paper I said that, without paying much attention to the outside world. And Haldane was mostly concerned with making the stupidest puns that he could possibly make. So a biochemistry professor came up to him, and I was overhearing when this happened in a reception, and said, "We're honored to meet you, Professor Haldane. These are my students. We are extending the Haldane relations, which are biochemical kinetic rules." And Haldane went, "Roof, roof, roof. So have I, you know, been married, you know." And that was about the depth of the discussion. So there was nothing. Anyway, he was a massive character. Okay. In the 1920s, he worked out the mathematics of it. Although people had done special cases before, he wrote paper after paper working out the mathematics of natural selection. And those are sort of founding papers. I'm mostly not going to refer directly to those papers, but do everything in a more simple algebraic way. So let me turn this off. I might reproject something later and see if it goes away. I think we'll have the usual problem, which is of the blue stuff, but it will disappear in a couple of minutes. So what we're going to do is imagine a population with, at first we're going to imagine just a haploid population, a haploid organism, in which there are two genotypes, and we'll call them big A and little a. And we're going to have numbers of these, N's of big A and N's of little a. And we're going to imagine that they're reproducing, they're giving rise to different numbers of offspring in discrete generations. We're just going to be asexual here. I say haploid, but effectively asexual, except of clonal inheritance. So that the new equations for the number of big A's and the number of little A's will just be what they were before times how many offspring each had. That reflects probability that they survive times the number of offspring if they do survive. And so you have the rather obvious equations. You take each one and multiply it by this, which is its absolute fitness, and we're going to make a distinction between absolute fitness and relative fitness in a moment. Now, you can go on from there. You could say, well, let's just imagine that this happens generation after generation. Then, of course, the multiplier capital W sub big A or capital W sub little a applies. And then you would have that the after T generations for the big A's, they're what they were originally, times this W big A
but you multiply it t times. Okay.
And that is fine, but somebody might come along and say, wait a second now. You can work out from that what the dynamics will be of the gene, of the frequencies of these two types as these two clones grow exponentially, but at slightly different rates. That's fine, but somebody might come along and say, okay, that's a nice model, but it's not real biologically. Why? Because many, many organisms have, could you push the off button? That's going to make the blue thing go away ultimately. Just push that, push the red thing again. See if that, yeah, that's it. With a little luck, there it goes. Now we're fine. Somebody may say, well, this is all very well, but real organisms have density-dependent population size regulation. Populations can grow, but only, resources are limited. They're going to run out of resources. Assuming that they can keep multiplying their clone size by the same number every generation is unrealistic because some density-dependent population size regulation will come in. And that's where the distinction between absolute and relative fitnesses starts to come in. I'm going to do a little math here. I'm going to take the ratio of, I'm perhaps doing this a little differently than the book, the numbers of big A's to the numbers of little a's. So now it's not the absolute numbers, it's the ratio of the one to the other, because it happens to work out nicely. And what will that be? Well, you just plug these equations in, and NA big A capital W big A over N little a capital W little a. So the ratio now is the old ratio times the ratio of these two fitnesses. You may think, well, so what? So you haven't really changed anything. Well, it's also going to be, if we take the, let's ask about the frequencies of the two clone types. One of them is going to be, we'll make a thing called p, little p big A, and that is the ratio of n sub big A to the total of both of them. We can also do that for little a to the total of both of them. Fine. And you can see immediately, if you look at this, that the ratio of little p big A to little p little a also follows nice rules. It follows rules that if you were to take the ratio of these two expressions, you can see something immediately, which is the denominator is in both of them and cancels out top and bottom. So the denominator actually disappears, and that says that the ratio of gene frequency of clone frequencies is the same as the ratio of numbers, and therefore it too follows this rule of the ratio of gene frequencies is equal to the gets multiplied every generation by this ratio. Now, we still haven't escaped from population size regulation. So what we're going to do is to say, let's make one further assumption here. Let's assume that population size regulation comes in by, say, running out of resources and hits everybody equally. Now, that's a particular assumption. It's not always true. But so what it does is, say, imposes an extra mortality on everybody. So it says, well, if you're at a low population density, it doesn't impose much mortality on everybody. If you're at a high population density, it kills off two-thirds of everybody, let's say. But suppose it's true that the population size regulation, the density-dependent mortality or reduction in fertility is
equally applied to everyone irrespective of their genotype. So this gene, whatever it is, that's distinguishing these two clones, is this gene is nothing to do, whatever it does to you phenotypically, it's nothing to do with your ability to survive population size regulation. So if we're willing to make that assumption, then something very interesting happens. Because then it turns out that although, let's say you're at low population density, so there are lots of resources around, not too many organisms, and we have our two clones, and we have the probabilities of survival, so this is the probability that you survive to have offspring, and suppose that's 90% here and 80% there. So it differs. It differs. That survival does depend on the genotype. And let's say number of offspring, this is average number of offspring. Let's say these have on average 2 offspring each, and these have 3.1 offspring each. And then we have density-dependent mortality. And that might be probability of survival, is what I'll put down here. Let's say it's 90% for everybody. Okay, not dependent in any way on the genotype. So then we might say, okay, how many offspring do you have? And the answer would be the product of these three numbers. So it would be 90% times 2 times 90%. So that is, I claim that's 1.62. Let's see if I've got it right. 90% times 90% is 0.81 times 2 is 1.62. Now, I did these numbers off the top of my head, so I have no idea if I can. So we have 0.72 times 3.1, which this is the old-fashioned way of, tell me if I get it wrong. Okay, so there you have it, a low population density, the fitness is the absolute fitness, which is the number of offspring, number of newborn offspring that reproduce per newborn. So it's the W, capital W, is that. Now suppose I take a case with a high population density. So that's one case. Well, everything will basically be the same. It'll be 0.9 and 0.8 for the early survival in the early part of the life cycle. That's genotype dependent. Number of offspring, the expected number of offspring, again, 2 and 3.1. But now, the density-dependent mortality, survival, I'll say, is instead of 0.9, it might be 0.09 and 0.09. Now only less than 10% of everybody is surviving because you're at a higher density, the food is running out, and random starvation is happening. And then you might say, well, what are those products going to be? Well, you can actually see they differ by a factor of 10, so it'll be 0.162 and 0.2232. Okay. And this is all by way of persuading you that yes, the fitnesses will change as a result of the density-dependent mortality, but provided it hits everybody equally, the ratio of the fitnesses won't change. So we can think of these capital W's, and an ecologist would come along and say, no, those capital W's aren't going to remain constant. But a geneticist might say, well, maybe I can get away with assuming that I have an eraser, assuming that the ratios of things are constant. So I'm going to argue that when you have these gene frequency formulas, you can take the capital W over capital W, which was there in each generation, and say those numbers won't be constant, but they will stand in the same ratio to each other. So the ratio of this to this is the same as the ratio of that to that. So ratios of them are constant in the face of population density regulation, if the population density regulation doesn't involve this locus. So there is another thing you can get that's called the relative fitness. So it's called relative fitness. And it has the property that as the population grows, it might be getting from low density to high density or whatever, or hurricanes might be occurring, all sorts of things could happen. But as long as you're able to assume that the ratio, that the fitnesses stand in the same ratios, that the mortality, the extra mortality that hits is random, or the extra reduction of fertility is random, then you can assume that those ratios will be constant and use them as if they're going to be constant. And that's a distinction. Okay, I've run out of time, but that's the distinction that's very, very important. It is always important to be absolutely clear on whether you're talking about absolute fitness or relative fitness. So where we're going from here on Wednesday, because Monday is off, where we're going from here is to use a notion of relative fitness, make an assumption of constant relative fitnesses of genotypes, and work out, as Haldane did, the equations for the changes of gene frequency. And the thing that you accomplish by all that is by making this assumption that density-dependent mortality is independent of genotype, to the extent that that's true, you can sort of factor out the ecology from the population genetics. And you get formulas for changes of gene frequencies that don't pay any attention to what the ecology is doing. That's very frustrating for ecologists, but it's very convenient for people doing genetics. So we'll pick it up there next time. I have received a number of homeworks from you. I will, at a later time, acknowledge to all of you that I've got the homeworks. And when you get the acknowledgement, you can relax and assume the homework got there.